believe the worst thing to ever happen to you was actually the best. She was queen of silver linings.
She should have bunked you with Toby or Cleaver, Nova said to her cousin, and doubled up with me.
She had her own room as a forewoman at Northwood Point. She wasn't about to demote herself now that she's captaining Odyssey.
Nova rolled her eyes.
Come on, Nova. I'm not that much of a drag to hang out with. You could at least try to mask your disappointment.
It's not you, Saul. I promise.
Oh, I know.
He said.
It's Dylan. You like her.
That's not true.
But even as she said it, her heart beat wildly in her chest. That night of cards flashed in her mind. Dylan betting bold, throwing back drinks, shooting coy smiles across the table. She'd kissed Nova before staggering to bed, then claimed the next morning that it was a mistake.
It can't happen again, she'd said. I can't be involved with my subordinates.
Nova had agreed. She hadn't gone looking for the kiss. But after it happened, she kept thinking about it constantly, watching Dylan's mouth whenever she spoke, imagining it pressed against her own. She looked away from Sullivan, her cheeks feeling warm.
A word of advice? Never get involved with your boss,
her cousin went on.
Murky waters. Tragic endings.
Don't waste your breath, Sol. There's nothing there.
Whatever you say.
His boots clanked off.
That's how you're gonna leave things?
Nova called after him, swiveling in the chair.
Where the hell are you going?
Sullivan paused in the doorway.
I gotta record a message for Miko. Let her know I'll be gone for a while. I'm gonna miss the twins' birthday again. Working research was supposed to fix this problem.
Miko will understand, Nova said. It's not like you can control distress calls.
It's not her I'm worried about. It's the boys. They're just four, and all they're gonna see is Daddy missing another party.
He prodded the door frame with the butt of his fist, mouth in a hard line.
Anyway, I'm serious about that advice, Nova. Dylan's not worth it. She's selfish, and even if she wasn't, she'd manage to get you fired if things ever went south.
I appreciate you helping me get this job, but I can take care of myself from here.
She turned back to the window.
I'd just hate to see you.
Good night, Saul.
Long after the din of his boots faded on the catwalks, Nova was still staring at the stars. At 0900 hours the next morning, Dylan called for cryostasis. Thea reported to a small room positioned below the bridge and at the very nose of the ship, where cylindrical glass compartments lined the perimeter. As she'd been settling in the night before, the ship had engaged FTL. Thea had felt a subtle pressure as they accelerated, then nothing. When she'd found a window to peer from come morning, the stars outside were thin white streaks. Now, in the windowless cryostasis room, there was no way of sensing that Odyssey was barreling toward Ocles at nearly 100 times the speed of light.
System check?
Dylan barked at Sullivan.
FTL drive running, steady, at 80%. That's the fastest I feel comfortable pushing Odyssey for a trip this long. Anything more could weaken the inertia suppressor, and then we're bugs on a windshield.
Course. Plotted.
Nova confirmed.
We'll be pulled out of FTL and stasis as we close in on Ocles. Perfect,
Dylan said.
Until then, sweet dreams.
She entered some commands into a processing unit in the middle of the room. The doors to each chamber slid open. Thea chose one beside Dr. Tarlow. After she stepped inside, the doors slid shut, and Thea leaned back, resting her head in the designated area, her arms in the wrist cuffs. A fan kicked on. A few minutes later, she sensed reality shifting. It was like that moment between dreaming and waking, a realm of limbo. Thea grew vaguely cold. Her eyelids became heavy. Through the chamber's glass door, she saw Dylan close her eyes across the room. And then Thea, too, was drifting. It was not as quick as yawning, like Sullivan had promised. Thea moved in and out of sleep. If she dreamed, she didn't remember the details, and when she was awake, her thoughts weren't much better than nightmares. The distress call, what they might find on Achlis, where she'd find herself in a few months. Thea could think, but she couldn't see or hear or feel. She only knew that she existed, that her body filled space, that she was trapped as the ship drew steadily nearer to its destination. Thea was floating, suspended, a sample in a jar of formaldehyde. Nova dreamed of stars and flying. She was alone on a small transport ship, chasing a beacon that led her to a space station with a massive breach. Inside, objects floated in zero gravity, droplets of water, droplets of blood, a thin silver bracelet. Something hovered near the far airlock. A person, wearing a leather jacket and fitted pants, short, dark hair splayed out around their head like a halo, and a stun gun was holstered at their thigh. Dylan. Nova pushed through the space station, propelling herself off ladders and walls until she reached the woman. She grabbed her, spun her around. Dylan's eyes were missing, replaced with gaping holes. A scream tore from Nova's throat, and then she was back on her ship, drifting among the safety of stars. Time passed at a rate she couldn't calculate, her memories fogged. And then there was a beacon again, and a space station on the radar. The dream repeated. Lisbeth Tarlow swam through darkness. It was thick, viscous. It choked and smothered. Just before snatching her last breath of air, the liquid thinned, transforming into clear water. Dark seaweed danced below, tendrils glinting. Lisbeth's toes grazed the uppermost blades. There was a voice in her head. "Don't tell them. Don't tell. Don't." And then an echo from somewhere deep in the water. "Tell. Tell them. Tell them now." Waking was what felt like yawning, satisfying, eager, an overdue stretch. When Thea opened her eyes, the world was blinding. Her limbs felt detached from her body and heavy, so heavy. The door to her chamber was open, and she could hear a distant sound, ebbing, flowing. As it grew clearer, she recognized it as the proximity alarm from when they'd approached the Lethe Belt. 2 months ago. Had it really been that long? Nova shot by her line of vision, a blur of brown skin and moss-green jumpsuit as she tore for the stairs. The others descended from their chambers, stretching and groaning. Thea stepped onto the metal floor of the cryostasis room, surprised that she didn't find the weight of her own frame a labor. She'd expected her knees to buckle beneath her, to have lost all her muscle. Didn't hospital patients have to relearn how to walk after months in a bed? But Thea only felt a vague tightness in her joints, a stiffness that suggested she'd dozed off in an awkward position for a few hours. "Bridge!" Dylan snapped, and Thea told her legs to move, following the others from the room and up a flight of stairs. On the captain's orders, everyone strapped into their seats on the bridge, but Dylan lingered near the window a moment, fiddling with a silver bracelet on her wrist. Achlis loomed in the distance. The day side was a scorched expanse of barren, endless brown. The night side was bathed in shadow, seemingly black from their position. Thea didn't think the Terminator looked very habitable. If there was water along that meridian, it wasn't in any large quantity. From Odyssey, the land between the day and night sides simply looked brownish-gray. "I reviewed the updates that came in from Hevitz while we were under," Dylan said. "They've confirmed that Black Quarry is still unresponsive, and shortly after we entered stasis, an additional backup crew was shipped out. They will be arriving in roughly 26 hours. In the meantime, we're to sit down and get in touch with Black Quarry, figure out what happened." Dread laced through Thea's body. Backup should have been reassuring, but all it did was make her wonder why backup was even needed to begin with.
Wasn't the Odyssey crew enough? Did Hevitz know something they weren't sharing? This all felt suddenly much larger than her internship and the experience point she was hoping to add to her applications when returning home. Toby had been right all along, just like the foster warden. I'm really not qualified for this. The planet reminded Nova of a massive eyeball, the Terminator roping around the rock like a murky brown iris. It stared, and she stared back. She double-checked Odyssey's radiation shields, active and running strong. F1 was only a red dwarf star, cooler, smaller, and far less luminous than the Trios' and Cradle's suns, but it was just as capable of burning them up if they flew too close for too long. She kept them on course, and soon the pilot's chair was shuddering against Nova's back, Odyssey entering a dance with gravity. Here comes the fun part. She engaged the rear thrusters, and the ship roared. Inertia suppressor readings spiked on the dashboard during entry, then dropped off as the G-force exerted on the ship also lessened. The pressure came from all angles, though, her blood beating like a fury in response. Grip firm on the yoke, Nova pulled them out of their dive, and her heart hammered in her chest. God, she'd missed this. Cruising some 3,000 meters above the scorched side of the planet, Nova turned her attention to the radar. Tracking software, Dylan prompted, as if she'd thought of it first. Already on it. A beacon blipped on the screen, somewhere in the Terminator. Nova grabbed the radio. Celestial Envoy, this is Odyssey. Do you read me? Silence. Celestial Envoy, this is the Hevitz manned Odyssey, responding to a company-issued distress call. Do you copy? Nothing. Let's go to them, Dylan said. Nova adjusted their course and flew on. As they left the scorched side of the planet behind them, visibility grew worse, slipping into something akin to twilight. What Nova could make out of the planet below appeared rugged, mountains and ravines, crevices and craters, and the sonar mapping depicted something similar on her dash. The infamous Achilles storms were absent. For now. Well into the Terminator, and nearly on the dark side of the rock, they finally came upon the research and exploration ship that had transported the Black Quarry crew to Achilles months earlier. Celestial Envoy stood out against the rugged landscape, the polished exterior winking under Odyssey's lights. But nothing winked from within. No lights, no signs of activity. Set us down at a distance, Dylan ordered. Nova took Odyssey in wide circles, searching out a place to land. Achilles was a mess of crevices and cracks and spears of rock that shot upward from the ground like angry blades. But with careful work at the yoke, she eventually set them down several kilometers west of Celestial Envoy. Nicely done, the captain said, giving Nova a rare smile. It was the first of the day, and should have brightened Nova's spirits, but her stomach was uneasy. She powered Odyssey down. The sound of harnesses releasing filled the bridge. Nova knew what would come next, gear and stun guns and flashlights. Search and rescue. This was what she'd wanted, to prove herself a worthy and skilled pilot who Hevitz couldn't wait to get on their payroll. She'd just expected to do it by more traditional means. It was too late for wishful thinking. The only way out was through. Nova released her harness. Theo waited in the cargo bay alongside the others as Sullivan suited up and stepped into the airlock. After opening the exterior door to the elements, he checked Achilles' atmosphere with a handheld device, then returned to the cargo bay.
Everything looks stable. Roughly 76% nitrogen, 23% oxygen, and 69/1000ths of a percent carbon dioxide, plus trace amounts of argon, methane, and helium.
CO2's a touch high, Nova pointed out. Dylan batted a hand. People have worked in worse.
For an hour or two, Sullivan said, tucking the device into his pocket. not indefinitely.
Well, we're following Black Quarry's protocols while on Aklis, so it's environmental suits for everyone, so long as we're exposed to the elements.
Dylan pointed to one of the lockers lining the perimeter of the cargo hold.
Thea located the smallest suit and pulled it on. The material was thin but durable, not quite skin-tight, and not an impairment to her mobility, either. Compared to the numerous layers she'd been used to wearing the past month while gathering water samples at Northwood Point, it felt almost freeing. A utility belt built into the suit hugged her waist, and reinforced panels lay across her chest and biceps to monitor her vitals. The bulkiest and heaviest part of the suit fell across her shoulder blades, where the oxygen reserves were stored.
"Everyone start your clocks," Dylan continued. "We've each got about 10 hours of oxygen and should be back long before those run low, but keep an eye on the time."
On Dylan's cue, Thea reset the watch that was built into the wrist of the suit. Milliseconds began ticking off. The crew pulled on their helmets, and Thea hurried to do the same. When it clicked into place, creating a seal with her suit, her vitals flickered on the helmet's glass visor, just in the corner of her vision. It was fancy tech, but also intimidating. Having her pulse and blood pressure constantly displayed only made Thea think of all the types of employees to have worn these suits before her, the situations they saw themselves in, the need to even have vitals monitored to begin with.
"I'm not qualified for this," she thought, and her pulse readings spiked in response.
Thea exhaled through her nose, forcing away the thought as she tried to steady her breathing. The last thing she needed was to burn through her oxygen too quickly. The numbers fell, stabilized.
"One thing at a time."
That was how Thea had gotten here, after all. One assignment at a time, one aced test, one perfect essay, one application, one internship, and now one foot after the other yet again. Toward Celestial Envoy, then through it, then back to Odyssey. Back home, back to her life, her future. She could do this. Dylan punched a button to open the airlock. They all stepped in. Another punch to seal it, a third to open the exterior door. The gangplank lowered, and Aklis beckoned. He'd seen them coming. In the endless state of near darkness, it had been impossible to miss. First, the emergency tracking software had been engaged remotely. He'd been scavenging the ship again, restocking his supplies, and the steady beep, beep, beep drew him to a halt. When he'd raced for the observation deck, he could make out the ship in the distance, a tiny star shooting toward Celestial Envoy. It held a search and rescue crew. He was sure of it. They'd kill him for what he'd done. And what he hadn't done, and who he was. The boy retreated into the shadows. His eyes adjusted, almost instantly now. The last 2 months had forced him to adapt, this much was certain. He would need a plan, carefully constructed, foolproof. Earning trust in a situation like this wouldn't be easy. The boy breathed deeply, envisioning every stairwell and hallway and turn he'd need to navigate before moving. Then he pushed off the railing and ran.
3. The Search. Celestial Envoy, Aklis, Fringe 1 System.
"This isn't right," Sullivan said as they drove, his voice crackling in Thea's ear.
The helmets were linked for wireless communication, and it was strange hearing him when he wasn't even in Thea's rover.
"It's too dark. They're not answering. I got a bad feeling."
No one said anything, not even Dylan, who Sullivan's words were surely meant for.
"Look, I got a family to think about," he went on. "Maybe we just wait for the backup crew. They're only 20-something hours behind us."
26 hours, Dylan snapped from out of view. "And I've got a family who's part of Black Quarry. Now, for the love of God, shut up.
Driving around all these craters is harder than it looks.
Theo was relieved when he fell quiet. Sullivan's fears mirrored her own and were making her pulse readings jump again. Dr. Tarlow gave Thea a nudge with her elbow, followed by a reassuring nod that seemed to say, "Don't worry." Thea had always respected the doctor, admired her greatly, but this lie was so obvious that a tiny ember of resentment began to burn inside her. How could anyone not be worried right now? "Never meet your idols," Thea remembered Mel saying. "They rarely live up to your image of them." As Cleaver drove, following Dylan's rover toward Celestial Envoy, Thea tilted her head back, looking out the moonroof that spanned the entire length of Rover 2. A star-pocked blanket stared back. The rover was heavy-duty, a true all-terrain vehicle, unlike the drafty, glorified golf cart she'd driven around Sotir's Caps back at Northwood. Behind the bench seat she and Dr. Tarlow occupied was a spacious rear for hauling equipment, accessible by a hatchback door. Its window was narrow, and through it, Thea could see Odyssey shrinking in the distance, the cloak of twilight and wafting dust swallowing it whole. When Celestial Envoy finally entered the glow of the rover's headlights a few minutes later, it looked nothing short of ominous. Where Odyssey was small and slender, with rooms stretched out over the course of two levels and a cargo bay, this ship was monstrous. The gangplank was already lowered, and the ship's innards bared to the night. Rover 1 lurched to a halt, and Cleaver stepped on the brake, halting Rover 2 just a few meters back.
"It's open,"
Sullivan said from the first vehicle, his voice again as clear as though he was sitting beside Thea in Rover 2.
"It shouldn't be open like this."
Ignoring Sullivan's concerns, Dylan climbed from Rover 1 and motioned for everyone to follow her on foot.
"Maybe Sullivan has a point," Thea felt like saying.
But she wouldn't. Didn't. "One thing at a time. Follow this order, then the next. She would get through this."
She scrambled from the vehicle and, with the wind nudging at her back, followed the rest of the team up the gangplank. Cleaver had his ray rifle out, and everyone else from Rover 1 held stun guns at the ready. Thea flexed her fingers around the flashlight she'd taken from Odyssey, unsure what to do with her hands. At Northwood Point, she'd carried a stun gun on the ice caps to protect against lynx and wolves. Yet, here she was, in a situation where she truly might need a weapon for once, and she was unequipped. As the crew moved up the gangplank, lights from their helmets bobbed like cautious fireflies, the flashlights mounted to their pistols and rifles, cutting into the depth of the cargo bay.
"Can someone get the power back up?" Dylan asked.
"On it,"
Toby responded. His footsteps clanked off, a lone flashlight beam moving deeper into the cavernous ship. Thea scanned the hold. As far as she could tell, it was empty. And overrun. Storage crates and drilling gear were strewn about. Shuttles and rovers would have made sense, but there were no vehicles, at least not that Thea could see. The floor was awash with raked markings, like a giant garden till had torn open the metal. Wires from the overhead utility lights hung like sweeping jungle vines. She'd seen enough horror movies to know Toby shouldn't have gone off on his own. Actually, now that she'd had a decent look at this part of the ship, it seemed safest that they all turn around and return to Odyssey immediately.
"What the hell?"
Sullivan had paused in the middle of the hangar, his flashlight falling on something decidedly human-shaped. Thea edged closer, freezing when she saw what lay there. A corpse. Thea staggered, alerts flashing in her visor. The middle-aged man lay on his back, pale skin shriveled, and sunken eyes staring vacantly. An angry slash had torn open his neck, and the front of his drilling uniform was stained reddish-black. Sullivan stood quickly, his flashlight trailing over the blood beneath the body, following more smudges and spatters across the floor. Another two bodies lay crumpled near the base of a set of stairs that led deeper into the ship. Their throats were also slit, their eyes wide and lifeless. All three corpses were frozen solid, the Achilles elements having preserved them before much decomposition could occur. Thea gagged. She'd never seen a dead body before, let alone three, and the corpses might have made her truly sick if it weren't for the alerts flashing in her visor. They slammed her back to reality, ordering her to regain control of her breath.
"We should fall back," Sullivan said.
"We were instructed to sweep the ship," Dylan responded.
"It looks like we just walked into a war zone."
"Then maybe instead of yelling at me, you should get your gun out and start searching the place. There could be survivors."
One moment, Sullivan was standing in the middle of the cargo bay, and the next, he was towering over Dylan, the glass of his helmet grazing hers.
"I am not dying for you, Dylan. This is bad. Something bad happened, and you need to get your head out of your..."
Dylan kneed him in the gut, and in the time it took Sullivan to mutter a curse, she threw her hands into his chest, sending him stumbling backward.
"Here's how it's going to be," she said, addressing the entire team as Sullivan gasped for air. "We're splitting into two groups and scouring this ship from top to bottom. If you don't like that idea, I will escort you back to Odyssey and put you under cryo until this is over. I don't need cowards right now. I need people who can follow orders. And right now, those orders are to search for survivors."
Sullivan glared. Thea thought it was good they were all suited up, or else Sullivan's fist might be finding a new home in Dylan's cheek. She thought also that being in cryo right now might be a blessing.
"So," Dylan continued, "does anyone agree with Sullivan?"
Cleaver hoisted his ray rifle.
"Only in the fact that I'm not dying."
"Right you are. You take half the crew and search top, down. I'll handle bottom up. Sullivan, I don't even want you in my sight. You and Tarlo go with Cleaver. Nova and the kid are with me."
Nova hesitated, looking between the two teams.
"And Toby?"
"Toby, sweep the engine room while you're there, then join whichever group is closest."
"Roger,"
he said in their ears.
"You don't think maybe we should all stick together?"
Nova said, her eyes still on the first corpse.
"It'll be faster this way. Two decent shots per group."
"I can shoot if you give me a gun," Thea told Dylan. She'd never fired a stun gun at a live target, but she'd been required to take a basic firearm safety course and log 20 hours of target practice before starting her internship. She liked to think that she was proficient enough to at least defend herself without posing a risk to others.
"Look, kid, until I actually see you shoot, I'm not blindly trusting that you're a good shot."
Dylan jerked her chin toward the pilot.
"Let's move."
Thea almost left it at that. She almost nodded and accepted Dylan's words as law. That's what she would have done in the classroom. But as her eyes swept the hold again, she was reminded that they were very far from a classroom. They were on a distant planet, searching a ship that looked like it had witnessed war. There were bodies at her feet. Bodies with slit throats. They'd died at the hands of someone else, and everyone but Thea and Dr. Tarlo was armed. Even Toby, a scrawny communications tech who couldn't manage to keep mustard off his shirt, had a stun gun. Thea had just as much right as anyone to protect herself. She was soft-spoken, but not meek. She followed instructions, but not if they were flawed. She was not going to die on this rock because someone as petty and short-sighted as Dylan Lowe refused to arm her own team.
"Quit calling me kid," Thea said,
barely recognizing her own voice.
"And give me a stun gun."
Dylan blinked at her.
"You know, I've been thinking,"
Thea continued, knowing her words were transmitting to everyone.
"Maybe you're too close to all of this. Maybe your father being a part of Black Quarry is affecting your ability to..."
"Enough!" Dylan spat.
"Here."
She pulled a spare gun from her belt and passed it to Thea, grip first.
"This is the safety," she said, pointing. "And this, I know how to use it."
Dylan pushed a spare battery mag into Thea's chest.
"Just don't kill anyone."
Thea didn't point out that she would have to squeeze the trigger a dozen or more times to cause any serious damage to a grown adult. She'd made herself heard, and in the moment, that was enough.
"Well, shit," Toby thought as he stared at the ship's Corarium reactor.
He'd had little trouble getting to the engine room, and despite its massive scale and series of catwalks, even less trouble finding the reactor. It was on the first level, directly off the hangar. What was puzzling was that it was intact. He'd seen the blood on the hangar floor, same as everyone else, noted the botched state of the supplies held there. One look at that mess, and Toby had suspected pirates. When Sullivan started yelling about dead bodies, he was damn sure of it. Corarium was the life force of the entire Union, powering reactors that made FTL travel possible, and fueling cities for durations that put the capabilities of Earth-era energies to shame. It wasn't uncommon to hear that a freighter hauling Corarium had been robbed. Pirates would even take the ship, if they could manage. A Corarium reactor could fetch a fat sum on the black markets, after all. Celestial Envoy was a research ship, not a freighter, but it didn't seem unreasonable for a pirating crew to try to steal the reactor, assuming they'd picked up some of Black Quarry's activity. Criminals tended to lurk in the uninhabited quadrants of space, and Achilles was pretty far off the grid. Hell, the whole of the F1 system was considered off-grid. But here sat the Corarium reactor, covered with a thin layer of dust, the sides of the 3-meter cube plastered with radiation signs, and every last piece of piping and tubing still connected. No one had even breathed on the reactor, let alone tried to steal it. Toby turned quickly, the light on his stun gun feebly scanning the room. The door he'd entered still stood ajar in the distance. Dylan had been shouting orders about splitting up to search the ship when he first reached the engine room. Now the crew was silent, except for the occasional "clear" or "that way" resounding in his ear. He backed away from the reactor, pulse readings ticking up slightly.
"It was just pirates," he was supposed to be saying right now,
the crew laughing along with him.
"Nothing but a band of space thieves."
The lights. Dylan had asked for the lights. Toby tilted his head back, following the piping that snaked to the upper levels of the engine room. He found the nearest stairwell and climbed. Several flights and a catwalk later, he located a row of breakers. All three of the main power grids were off, along with the backup generators. Someone had deliberately killed the power and then turned the backup supply off, too.
That didn't make much sense.
Reactors had fail-safes installed so that they automatically powered down if they malfunctioned. No one should have needed to completely cut the power. And to kill the generators, too?
Toby's eyes darted between the breakers, his pulse reading climbing another 2 points.
"Clear!"
Cleaver barked through the intercom, and Toby dropped his weapon in surprise. It clattered onto the grated metal floor, echoing through the engine room.
"Sullivan should be here,"
he thought as he retrieved the weapon and holstered it at his thigh.
"I know computers, not power grids. There's gotta be a reason they manually powered down every last system."
This was Toby's punishment for wanting to be the hero, for thinking the engine room would provide an easy explanation to Black Quarry's silence, a magic bullet he could relay to his crew. And now he had to get the lights on before Dylan ate him alive. Toby straightened to face the breakers. He'd bring the generators back up, he decided. It would be enough to get some lights on, and maybe after a search of the ship, they'd know why the Black Quarry crew cut their own power, and if it was safe enough to reinstate. Toby reached for the lever labeled Emergency Generators. Using both hands, he began to prime the breaker. They found more dead bodies as they continued, Not in large numbers, Thea noted, which was concerning in itself. The crew quarters had been empty, save for a few deceased. One strangled in his bunk, bedsheets disheveled. Another with his head bashed in near the showers. It wasn't that Thea wanted to see hundreds of corpses, but if only a handful of the crew were dead, they should have come across survivors by now. Entering the mess hall, Thea panned the cavernous room with her weapon. Holding her flashlight alongside the barrel, she found overturned chairs and trays, maybe a half dozen bodies scattered throughout. Nova checked them all, prodding at them with her ray rifle.
"More of the same,"
the pilot said, her voice crisp in Thea's helmet.
"Stabbed, slit throat. This one was strangled and... Hey, look at that!"
Thea followed the pilot's flashlight, which moved from the strangled corpse to the plates of food on the tables. Shriveled fruit and scraps of bread were covered in a fine blanket of white, fuzzy mold. Frozen solid, it almost looked like crystallized snow.
"How'd this grow in the cold?"
Nova said.
"Maybe it grew earlier," Thea offered, "before the ship was exposed to the elements."
She didn't mean for it to come out a question. Even now, the exterior temperature reading on Thea's visor read negative 11 degrees Celsius, just a single degree warmer than when she'd walked up the ship's gangplank. Definitely not prime mold-growing temperature. Dylan's brow furrowed behind the glass of her helmet as she swept the room a final time.
"Clear,"
she announced, and exited the mess. Nova followed, and as Thea brought up the rear, new questions rattled in her mind. Why had someone exposed the entire facility to the elements, and where were they now? The deeper they moved into the ship, the more uneasy she grew, and Thea's fears were not diminished by the fact that she was now armed. In fact, she was starting to worry that a stun gun wouldn't help her at all. There didn't seem to be anything to shoot. No enemies, no survivors, nothing. The suspense of sweeping each room and hallway grew unbearable, and by the time they reached the aeroponics facility, Thea could no longer keep her pulse readings steady. Vertical racks of arugula, bib lettuce, and other leafy greens sat shriveled and crystallized, their overhead lights dead, and their roots as frozen as the microfleece membrane from which they grew. The nutrient-rich mist that once fed the plants had left the ground slick with a thin layer of ice, and as the women moved carefully through the vertical farm, their flashlights glinted and bounced off the frozen surface, causing shadows to stretch eerily across the room. Thea used to find similar moments in horror movies comical, but now she wished it was that simple, that this graveyard of a ship was nothing more than a scene in a film. That any second something would scare her senseless, but it would only be a member of the Black Quarry crew. A farm tech, appearing from behind a rack of spinach, happy to see them. Exiting the aeroponics farm, they found another dark hallway.
"Bridge should be that way,"
Nova said, pointing with a light mounted on her weapon.
"Nearly everything on this ship is automated, right down to flight control and..."
A screech filled Thea's helmet. She flinched and tried to cover her ears, but by the time her hands hit her helmet, the noise had stopped. Thea's ears rung in the newfound silence. She looked to the others. Nova was shaking her head, and Dylan still had one hand pressed to her helmet. Her lips moved, forming a swear Thea could read but not hear. The intercoms were dead. Barely a half hour after leaving Odyssey, and their gear was already failing. No, Thea's vitals were still flashing in the corner of her visor, so it wasn't an issue of power. It was an issue specific to communication, which wasn't much of a silver lining.
"What the hell just happened?"
Dylan appeared to be shouting, but her words were muffled and barely audible.
"No idea,"
Nova yelled back.
"Maybe something failed on Odyssey? Toby would know." "This is exactly why I keep telling Hevitz they need to update all their gear, not just give the latest and greatest tech to select rigs. Piece of..."
Dylan trailed off in favor of smacking at the side of her helmet, as if that would suddenly make the intercoms work again.
"Switch to external mics,"
Nova shouted, toggling a switch on the side of her helmet.
"Testing. Testing. Can you guys hear that?"
The pilot's words now projected into the hallway. They were nowhere near as crisp as when the comms had transmitted directly into Thea's ear, but it was preferable to having to shout through their helmets. Thea gave the pilot a thumbs up, then made the switch to her external mic as well.
"What I was trying to say," Nova continued, "is that Celestial Envoy's bridge is massive and has a double-cased, reinforced doorway. If the crew was looking to take shelter, they might have gone there."
Dylan nodded her on. Thea brought up the rear, the darkness right on her heels, her pulse still hammering. How had she ever enjoyed horror movies with Mel? They used to curl up together on the couch, limbs entwined beneath a blanket, as they took bets on who would die first. Usually, it was the poor schmuck bringing up the rear. The floor suddenly vibrated, and Thea froze. Dylan did, too. They glanced at each other just briefly, the pounding underfoot getting faster, closer, then spun, weapons ready. A figure rushed them, blinding light where his face should be, like his head was a mirror reflecting their flashlights back down the hall. But it wasn't a mirror. It was his helmet. Because it was... Thea barely had time to shove Dylan's arm up, sending the fired wave of electricity at the ceiling instead of into the man.
"Shit!"
Toby said, pulling up short.
"You nearly dropped me!"
"What the hell were you thinking?"
Dylan shouted, "creeping up on us like that."
"I was looking for you guys. My intercom stopped working."
He tapped the side of his helmet.
"So I had to run to catch up."
"You're supposed to be getting the lights back on."
"I threw the generators a little while ago."
"What?
Toggle your external mic. I can barely hear you."
Toby complied.
"I said I already threw the generators,"
he repeated, his words now much clearer.
"Emergency lights should boot any minute."
As if on cue, they flickered to life. Celestial Envoy illuminated in the same manner Northwood Point had before they left Sotir. White lighting lined the floors and hugged the doorways, casting everything in a cool glow. Thea wasn't sure if she preferred pure darkness or this new level of slim visibility. She'd still need her flashlight, only now she could see far enough behind Toby to mistake hanging ceiling panels or dropped gear as signs of life. Toby raised a hand.
"See?
Throw something next time. Call out. Use your damn flashlight to signal us. But if you go sneaking around like an idiot, you're gonna get a shock blow to the chest. And I'm not gonna be apologizing when you're lying on your back gasping for air. You read me?"
"Loud and clear, Captain."
Dylan spun on her heel and marched toward the bridge.
"Bitch,"
Toby muttered, but only Thea was near enough to hear it. The hallway led to a half flight of stairs, which the group took two at a time, Thea still bringing up the rear. On the landing, the reinforced doors Nova had mentioned were already open, the locking mechanism mangled and blackened.
"Electrical fire,"
Toby offered, as Dylan bent to inspect the damage.
"Or maybe pure force. Sullivan would know better than me."
"You said this would be the safest place," Dylan said, glancing at Nova. "That it was secure." The pilot shrugged, and Toby offered,
"You can override anything if you're desperate enough."
How reassuring, Thea thought. She reluctantly followed the others onto the bridge. It was easily five times larger than Odyssey's, with command stations spread out in a stadium fashion, the rows of stations descending as they approached the front of the room. Where Thea expected to see a windshield, there was only a wall of vid screens. She assumed they typically projected star charts, flight data, system reports, and whatever else the Celestial Envoy crew needed to keep their ship navigating smoothly. But now they were merely black.
"Systems are still booting, I think," Dylan said from one of the command stations. "Toby?"
He moved to help the captain, and Thea, desperate to no longer be at the tail end of their search party, descended the levels toward the front of the bridge. Nova did the same, her weapon held with precision, her movements quick and methodic as she cleared behind each station. Thea was so used to seeing the pilot lounging in the break room at Northwood, long legs kicked up on the table, contagious laugh resounding as she threw her head back at something Sullivan had said, that it was easy to forget she had military training. Improving her own grip on her weapon, Thea rounded another station. Her boot caught on something, and she toppled forward, the gun skittering out of her hands as she crashed to the floor. She rolled over to see what had tripped her and yelled out. Red alerts flashed in her visor.
"We got another body!"
Nova shouted. Thea scrambled away from the corpse, heart pounding. The cold had stopped the worst of the decaying process, and like all the bodies they'd crossed so far, it was impossible to guess at how long the man had been dead. His skin had shrunken and shriveled, his eyes recessing into his skull. He was wearing a set of Hewitt's coveralls and an unzipped jacket, but no environmental suit or helmet. A dusty tab lay across his shins. There was no knife wound on this corpse, no sign of strangulation. Instead, there were two holes in his skull, small near one temple, larger at the exit point on the other side. That was when Thea noticed the pistol resting near his knee. She couldn't stop staring at it or wondering how the man had gotten his hands on something that shot bullets. Hewitt's Industries certainly didn't supply any. The company's founder, Julian Hewitt, had been a pacifist, a lover of nature and animals, and was strongly against firearms. He'd passed nearly a century ago, but his surviving family had upheld his values, and even when the company's ownership transitioned to the first non-family member a few years ago, all of Julian's policies were still followed. This was why Thea had been trained with a stun gun, not a handgun. Why people like Dr. Tarlow were employed to monitor the environmental impact of their drilling. Why even in the most dangerous drilling locations or top-secret research facilities, workers were protected by security details boasting long-distance ray rifles. Employees shot to stun, not kill. They did due diligence both before and after. They valued life. Protect the future. Hewitt truly wanted to leave the universe better than they found it.
"Evans," Nova said, reading from the name patch sewn onto the man's uniform.
"He left us a note," Toby said.
Standing a few paces from the body, Toby's flashlight shone on a section of the floor where Evans had smeared a finger-painted message. Only the paint appeared to be blood.
"It got in us, and most are dead. Declan flew for help. Don't trust the kid."
Thea read it once, twice, again. Dylan dropped to a squat beside the body and reached out.
"Don't touch him!"
Thea shouted, her brain stuck on the first four words of the message, the analytical side of her jumping through the worst possibilities. Disease, infection.
"I'm in an airtight enviro suit, and I'm picking up the damn tab, not frisking the corpse," Dylan said. "Do I need your express permission?"
Thea shook her head adamantly, even though the question was rhetorical. The captain retrieved the tab, ran her gloved hand over the front to clear away the dust, and toggled it on. The screen remained dark.
"Dead," she said. "Let's try to find a charging pad. Could be some useful info on this."
"Hang on," Toby argued. "What about the rest of this message? Declan flew for help? Who's Declan? And it got in us? Do you think the air's toxic after all?"
Everyone's gaze drifted to Thea, intent and expecting. It took her a moment to realize they were waiting for a response, and then a moment longer to realize Dr. Tarlow wasn't going to burst onto the bridge to offer her professional opinion.
"There could be something in the air, I guess," she said finally.
"You guess?"
"Well, I don't have much to go on. The readings Sullivan took when we landed were fine. If it is something in the air, something that manifests after prolonged exposure,
We're not going to know unless someone volunteers to ditch their helmet, which would obviously be incredibly stupid. The group stared, mouths thin. What more was she supposed to say? It could mean anything, she concluded, folding her hands together. I honestly don't know.
Interns, Toby muttered.
You're not qualified for this. Declan's probably a pilot, she offered, wanting to help somehow.
Clearly, if he flew for help,
said Nova. But I don't understand where he flew. He couldn't have gone anywhere in the short-range shuttle, and if Celestial Envoy was equipped with any long-distance transport models, a UT-800 like Odyssey or similar, I didn't see any in the hangar. If he took the only one, we could have passed him during cryo. Maybe we flew right by each other without even knowing it.
Dylan rubbed the back of her neck.
We should contact Hevitz, Thea said. If Declan was headed for the Trios, he's likely there by now.
Toby tapped a foot near the message.
Most are dead. Does that mean some of the team is still alive?
It has to, Dylan said.
He'd only have written "Don't trust the kid" if the kid was alive.
There was hope in her eyes.
While Thea wanted to feel it too, her optimism was fading, and, unlike Dylan, Thea didn't have a family member in Black Quarry to fan those feeble flames.
Except I doubt there were kids involved in Black Quarry, Nova pointed out. Trained Hevitz employees? Sure, but not kids.
I still think we should contact Hevitz, Thea said, this time loudly enough that no one could ignore her.
Dylan raised the tab.
After we get this thing charged, communications will be slow this far into the fringe, so there's no point contacting Hevitz until I can give them a conclusive report. Let's regroup with Cleaver.
She stooped to retrieve Evans's pistol, then straightened and led the way off the bridge. Lisbeth Tarlow was worried, not for herself, but for the others.
The standard diagnostics program is accessible, she told the man, but we're locked out otherwise.
She straightened from the medical bay computer. Cleaver was sifting through cabinets, though most of the equipment seemed to be scattered across the floor and counters, bloody fingerprints covering everything from gauze to scalpels. A shock rod lay forgotten by one of the isolation chambers. Sullivan stood watch at the med bay's sliding glass doors, though his eyes kept drifting to the mud-red smears on the regenerative beds and the footprints tracked between them. The tension in the air had been palpable when their intercoms had failed after leaving the observation deck. They'd switched to the external microphones and worked their way down through the administrative quarters, finding the hall empty and each suite locked. They'd come across maybe a dozen dead bodies in their sweep, but not a single survivor. Lisbeth could practically feel the apprehensiveness dripping off the men now. They hated the quiet, despised being cut off from Dylan's group, but the silence was a blessing to Lisbeth, comforting, like an old friend.
"And that means?" Cleaver asked, nodding at the computer.
Black Quarry medical files are secured, but third parties can still run blood work or body scans if someone gets injured.
Third parties?
Us, she said. We're the third party. Anyone not in Black Quarry can still use the lab for medical purposes. It's just that Black Quarry's research and medical files, the stuff that would be incredibly useful to us right now, are protected.
Ah,
Cleaver said, but given the way his brow wrinkled, Lisbeth still wasn't certain he was following.
There's nothing here, Sullivan growled. Let's keep moving.
She saw no reason to argue. Confidential or not, Lisbeth could guess what the medical files would say. Telling the others would only create panic. It was better this way. The silence, the unspoken words. It was safer. They left and moved down the hall, finding a research laboratory. It was in as poor a state as the med bay.
Its far wall was lined with standing freezer units, one of which had a shattered front door, shards of glass littering the honeycombed floor tiles. The adjacent walls were home to display mounts, currently flickering startup prompts on account of Toby rebooting the generators. Computer stations and the occasional storage unit underneath them basked in the electronic glow.
"Dead," Sullivan said, snatching a tab off a large metallic table in the center of the room.
He grabbed another, knocking a plate of frozen, half-finished food aside.
"Dead also."
And another.
"This one too."
"There's a charging caddy behind you," Lisbeth said, pointing. Cleaver grabbed it and wheeled it over, and as the men started loading tabs onto it, she moved past them, drawn to the standing freezers. Inside were at least a dozen cylindrical canisters, filled with what appeared to be dirt or mud, extracted during drilling. Even without power, the contents had been more or less preserved by Ocklease's frigid environment. One canister had been knocked on its side, but its mud-colored substance was still solid, dangling between the wire racks like dark icicles. It must have melted when Celestial Envoy first lost power, then refrozen as the ship cooled. Lisbeth leaned in for a closer look, the visor of her helmet scraping the glass door. The contents of several canisters in the back looked remarkably like corarium, viscous and dark. Something clicked beside her, then hummed. Lisbeth turned slowly, locating the sound. It was coming from a steel-gray, waist-high freezer in the corner. A temperature gauge on the side was set to 2 degrees Celsius. Not a freezer, then. Just a very cold fridge. A passcode keypad was positioned just beside the handle, but the word "unlocked" flashed up at Lisbeth. Perhaps it had been reset during the power reboot. She grabbed the lid and heaved it up, expecting to find more drilling samples. There was only an aquarium inside, roughly a meter wide and perhaps a half meter tall and deep. Suspended in the water was a long, leathery piece of black seaweed. She jumped back, visor flashing red.
"Something wrong?"
Sullivan called.
"No, sorry. I just lost my footing on some of this glass."
She towed the shards on the floor for emphasis.
"What's in the freezers?"
"Drilled samples, and this fridge is empty."
She lowered the lid.
"New passcode?" the keypad display prompted.
Lisbeth glanced over her shoulder. The men were again focused on the tabs, their backs to her. She entered her Hevet's ID into the keypad.
"Confirm passcode."
She entered it again.
"Accepted and secured."
Nova was growing uneasy, but she kept her grip steady on the ray rifle, her eyes keen as they moved through the halls. Once you put your nerves on display, you were only more likely to fail, a lesson that had been hammered into her by her flight instructors at the academy. Dylan led the way up to the next level, where shadows flickered over the threshold of an open doorway. A jerk of the chin from the captain, and Nova stepped forward, the rifle aimed into the room. Three heads snapped toward the doorway. Sullivan, Cleaver, and Tarlo gathered at a table in the middle of the disheveled research lab, sifting through tab data. Nova lowered her rifle.
"Find anything?"
Dylan asked as she pushed past Nova and strode in. She set the tab and pistol from the bridge on the table.
"Maybe,"
Cleaver said.
"Maybe? Are you looking at the same reports I am?"
Sullivan tossed one of the devices to Dylan.
"They've been drilling in a canyon due north of here. That tab has records for a dozen different drill points, and the log from the most recent drill was 2 months back." "And?"
Cleaver said. "And that's roughly when Hevet's issued the distress call on Black Quarry's behalf," Dylan answered. She looked back to Sullivan.
"There's nothing else? They drill that day and never bother to record another thing?"
"Not that I can see,"
Sullivan said.
Comm logs show their last report to Hevitz was sent on June 30th at around 0800. It was just one line. Complications, stand by. There are up